Marketing.
The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And now it's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello, good morning to you. 4 minutes past nine, Tuesday, the 17th of October, 2023. And this morning, for the first time on the way to work, there was frost on the ground. It is heading into autumn full time now, isn't it, in winter? I hope you're all very well indeed. We'll keep you warm here with loads of informative entertainment, entertaining content, hopefully. We've got lots coming up on the show, of course. Community Garda information is coming up for you just after 10, that and so much more besides. And you can raise your issues, have your conversations with us on 086 60 25000. WhatsApps and texts, WhatsApps and text to that number. You can send a WhatsApp voice message to, of course, to 086 60 25000. If you want to give us a call, it's 074 91 25000, 074 91 25000. And emails come into us, comments@highlandradio.com. And we're getting record viewership figures on the show these last few days too, so feel free to watch the programme if it suits you and your lifestyle and where you're at. You can watch us on YouTube, Highland Radio Ireland, on your smart TV. It normally has the YouTube app installed, or if you have a Fire Stick, YouTube's on that as well. Highland Radio Ireland, and like and subscribe. It's very useful. And if you can, you can watch, of course, across all your mobile devices using YouTube and also Facebook, Highland Hub, Highland Radio News and Sports. So whichever way you're with us, it's so great to have you on board. Really busy show yesterday. Lots of comments that came in over the course of the morning that we simply just didn't get to, but we will throughout the course of this morning as well. So please, I want you to understand that your efforts aren't to waste, and we read all comments. The Irish Independent this morning: the government is concerned for the safety of hundreds of Irish troops based in the Middle East amid fears of an escalation in violence in the region. Irish peacekeepers in Lebanon have been forced into groundhog mode, meaning they have taken shelter in designated bunkers during rocket attacks since Israel declared war following the attacks on its soil by Hamas. There are 340 Irish troops stationed in Lebanon. A UN headquarters in the south of the country, where eight Irish soldiers are based, was struck by a rocket on Sunday, but no one was injured, thankfully. The United Nations Interim Forces in Lebanon, UNIFI, is trying to establish where the rocket originated. Speaking ahead of an extraordinary meeting of the European Council today, Taoiseach Leo Varadkar said the possibility of the conflict escalating is a particular concern for Ireland, not least because it would only result in further unnecessary bloodshed, but also because we have peacekeeping troops in nearby Lebanon and Syria. I'll be raising the importance of opening up humanitarian corridors into Gaza to allow vital life-saving supplies to be brought in, and the EU is working closely with the UN on this issue. We will also discuss how to ensure that EU citizens who wish to leave can do so safely. Though that seems incredibly difficult, because the besieged Gaza is less than 24 hours from catastrophe. A catastrophe is hospitals run out of fuel. Hospitals in Gaza have just hours of generator fuel left, while water and other critical supplies have either run out or will do in around 24 hours, according to the United Nations. And you can imagine life there at the moment with an impending ground invasion, I suppose that's what you can call it, can't you, from Israel, and also 6,000 bombs dropped on an area half the size of Inishowen. Like, this is not a massive area. And, you know, some people obviously can leave, others can't. They're sick in hospital, they can't be moved. If they move, they die. They have no means of transport, and bombs dropping all around you. It is absolutely horrendous to imagine what it must be like. Well, Egypt warned last night that aid for the besieged Gaza Strip is stuck at its border due to Israel not cooperating. The UN and human rights groups have pleaded for supply lifelines to be fully opened, with Egypt warning Israel's total siege on the enclave means food, water and medical supplies are running perilously low. Now, that is outside the rules of war. War is horrific, but there are rules within it. And if Israel obviously is planning on annihilating Hamas. Hamas attacked Israel. It's an ongoing situation, but Hamas is not the Israeli people, the Palestinian people. Why aren't they being allowed a chance of survival? It's just, and we have Biden landing into Israel to confirm his unwavering support for Israel, but also, obviously, hopefully, diplomatic moves are afoot that if Israel feels it needs to avenge in a warlike fashion. I mean, it's going to do that, but not at the cost, a catastrophic cost of civilians. 3,000 already dead, and it could get much worse very quickly. Road policing strong, says McIntyre's figures show a drop in Garda checkpoints. This is the Irish Times. Garda enforcement of the rules of the road is strong, Minister for Justice Helen McIntyre said, after figures showed a drop in the number of Garda checkpoints being carried out amid calls for tougher policing measures. The Irish Times reported yesterday that the number of alcohol breath tests carried out at Garda checkpoints has dropped by more than half when compared to before the pandemic, while the number of Gardaí assigned to roads policing is at its lowest level since 2017. Responding to the new data, Minister of State Jack Chambers said there was a need to strengthen enforcement. Mr. Chambers made the comment as he announced a proposal. I'll get to that proposal, actually. It's in another paper. But I think this kind of aligns with what a lot of people say when they contact this show. They travel all around the country and very rarely, sorry for the noise of the newspaper, they very rarely encounter a checkpoint. The figures now back up those statements. The Irish Daily Mail, and of course we spoke extensively about health on the show yesterday and we'll continue to do so. We had two consultants who very bravely and very difficult for them spoke out about the horrendous situation at Letterkenny University Hospital. One described the situation as barbaric. A lack of investment means that the provision of service provision is at a tipping point and could collapse altogether. That is the concern. But where will the money come from? There'll be no second budget for the health service generally, despite a crisis looming this winter, senior cabinet figures have warned, the Irish Daily Mail reports. Hopes that cuts to the Department of Health annual budget would be filled by a bailout were dashed last night when cabinet ministers told the Irish Daily Mail that any additional monies would merely keep the lights on. It was revealed at... the problem is our problem up here is not that it's just keep the lights on, it's to keep half the lights on, because half the lights have already been extinguished, to continue that metaphor there. We're in a dire situation and there's extra investment needed, but the HSE are tightening their purse strings. It was revealed at the weekend that Fianna Fáil Health Minister Stephen Donnelly has told Fine Gael Public Expenditure Minister Pascal Donoghue that it was insane to cut the health budget in an election year. However, stuff the election year, what about people's health? But anyway, however, a minister told the Irish Daily Mail last night the supplementary will be to keep the lights on. There'll be no second budget. This comes as 5,000 workers across voluntary community groups for the elderly and disabled are set to go on indefinite strike today. Thankfully, that's been averted, by the way, though a great deal of stress and anxiety for those who rely on those services was not averted because they only found out this morning that the services that they rely on would be available to them. But it does seem a bit strange, doesn't it, with everything that's going on and with the amount of money we're supposed to have, that spending on health is cut and there's a recruitment freeze ongoing. And as we've been hearing from within Letterkenny University Hospital, things already dire there and no sign of any intervention. That being said, I'm told that Minister Stephen Donnelly, the health minister, will meet with GP representatives and consultant representatives following the coverage of that story. That remains to be seen. And what might come from that, we do not know. We've invited Stephen Donnelly onto the show to comment on that. He's not available because in the cabinet meeting, of course, we invited the local minister, Charlie McConlogue, onto the programme, extending the hand of goodwill and friendship. But as you would know, Minister McConlogue refuses to engage specifically with me on this programme. The Irish Daily Star this morning, this is what I was sort of almost referenced on the front of another paper, and I want to know what you think. Tougher penalties could be on the way for drivers who break road rules on bank holidays under plans to be considered by government ministers today. At a cabinet meeting in Dublin, new plans will be considered by Junior Transport Minister Jack Chambers. The meeting comes after another weekend of carnage on our roads. Six people were killed over recent days, which included two motorcyclists in separate crashes in Roscommon and Kerry. It comes just weeks after Mr. Chambers announced that a speed limit review had recommended cutting speeds on many major roads. Under the proposed legislation, Motorists who commit traffic offences like speeding on bank holiday weekends will face higher penalty points. Under the new Road Traffic Measure Bill 2023, powers would be granted to a minister to vary the number of penalty points during specific times when road safety risks are higher. But would that make much difference? Like, if you were going to introduce something, like, there are other countries that do it differently. So if you're caught speeding, depending on what it was, you'd be fined 600, 700 euro. That would stop people speeding, wouldn't it? Or I think it's one of the, I think it might be Sweden has a system, and I'll double check, but I believe it is, I read somewhere, has a system whereby if you are caught speeding, you're banned from driving instantly for a couple of weeks or a week or a few days. I mean, would that be enforced? I don't know, because we heard earlier on about the lack of checkpoints and what have you. But do you believe that we need staggered penalty points dependent on bank holidays? Would you like to see other measures such as higher fines, which I think probably would be more effective, or indeed, like we see in some other countries, instant bans, short period bans if you're caught speeding? And you'd have to categorise it. We're not talking maybe 55 and a 50, probably 120 and an 80 or something like that there. What do you think needs to be done? 086 60 25,000, or do you believe this is an overreach by government? The Irish Daily Mirror: a man yesterday formally denied murdering school teacher Aisling Murphy. Josef Puska, who's 33, replied through an interpreter not guilty when the charge was put to him at the Criminal Courts of Justice Complex in Dublin yesterday. The accused, who wore a grey suit and a cream shirt, will now stand trial in front of a judge and jury of 9 men and 3 women, which was selected yesterday. The trial, which jurors heard may last as long as 5 weeks, is expected to begin this morning in front of Mr Justice Tony Hunt. And finally, the Irish Sun must have been late to press yesterday, because this is news that broke late in the evening. 2 Swedish football fans were shot dead in Brussels last night in a suspected revenge attack by an alleged terrorist. The horror attack came before Sweden played Belgium in a Euro 2024 qualifier in the city. The match was abandoned at half-time as the players reportedly refused to return after the break. The crowd were told to stay in the stadium, but panic set in when word spread of the double killing 5 kilometres away, and many terrified fans fled with the killer still on the loose. The gunman was travelling on a moped and was heard shouting Allahu Akbar, an Islamic phrase for God is the greatest. And such is the way social media is now. Prior to this attack, he posted a video on social media identifying himself, his allegiances, and stating his sick, twisted motivation for what he was about to do. And also the videos circulating of him chasing down these fans and also escaping on a scooter. He was apprehended this morning and shot. I'm not sure if he was shot dead or not, but the weapon which he used to kill 2 people was recovered. And the understanding is at this stage that incident, his motivation or his justification, though there can be never any justification, but I hope you understand what I'm saying, is that apparently in Sweden, a lot of Qurans are being burnt and what have you, and it's not related to the instance, the situation in the Middle East. It's an internal Swedish situation. Right, so as you would know, we were talking extensively about health yesterday, and lots of you messaged in, and I want to just make sure that we give those messages the platform. I'm waiting for a new knee in June, says a listener. I got an x-ray on my hip. I need a new hip, just off the phone to the waiting list. I was told it will be over 4 years before I see a doctor about my hip. Well, you would be, sounds like, if you can come up with money in advance for your credit union or your savings or whatever it might be, a perfect example of the cross-border scheme, because there's no way you can endure 4 years with the need for a new hip. Another caller says, I was at the hospital yesterday morning. I had to be there for 8:30. I was there at 8:15 in the car park when I got the call to say that my procedure was cancelled. I took the day off work and everything. Another caller says, good morning. As long as I can remember, the Letterkenny University Hospital has been under-resourced and seems to be the poor relation of the HSC. Now it's become critical. Imagine that it's got to the stage that 78 GPs and 11 consultants have had to go public on this. What is our Taoiseach and Health Minister saying, and more importantly, doing? What about our local TDs? Quiet again, Bob Padraig McLaughlin. I fear that some tragedy will happen due to government and local TD inaction, and sadly only then something might be done. I try to avoid the forgotten county narrative, but all the evidence would suggest that we are. Now, when you say I fear that some tragedy would happen. If you listen to the words, and this, I don't mean this preachy, it sounds like I mean it preachy the way I started speaking there, but if you listen to the words of, if you listen to the words of the GPs and also the consultants, they are, we heard from one consultant yesterday who says that if you're lucky enough to get out of the emergency department, there's a possibility you could deteriorate because of the facilities that are available. That's a tragedy. GPs are saying that they're concerned to send particularly older people to the ED because a long sit for them before they get treatment might have a negative impact on their outcomes, up to and including death. That is a tragedy. So unfortunately, we are already seeing tragedies. And I'm not correcting you. I hope you understand that. I think cancer patients should not have to go and sit for hours among sick people in the AED. Pump away at money to LUH, but a lot other stuff needs addressing. Yes, of course, and that's an issue we've raised on this program through the testimony of listeners having to access cancer care. Even though you have a card that should have you fast-tracked, it doesn't always work. And we've had cancer patients sat in the ED and eventually left because they didn't feel it appropriate for them. We're joined on the programme by Tony O'Brien, former Director General of the HSE and columnist at the Sunday Independent. Tony, thanks for your time this morning and good morning to you.
Good morning.
We'll talk about funding for the HSC more generally. Given the sort of narrative that we hear about the amount of money that's available in the country and the importance of this, that and the other, can you get your head around the justification for the government not funding the HSC as even Stephen Donnelly, the health minister, might want, especially with a, and it shouldn't come down to this, but especially with an election looming?
Well, actually, it's pretty baffling. The numbers that were injected in the budget last week are totally unrealistic. They don't reflect even the cost of the HSE continuing to do what it already does. And they certainly don't reflect the ambitions of SlauncherCare, which are clearly to improve the quality of service. And I'm aware, obviously, of the local concerns that you were discussing on the programme yesterday about access times at the Letterkenny University Hospital, which unfortunately are a feature across the system. And there is this SlauncherCare plan in place, which has been making some progress in recent years. But to land the HSE with a €2 billion problem isn't going to help any patient anywhere in the country, unfortunately.
And it's an issue as well, too, that's felt by everyone, either directly or by one degree of separation. But getting on to sort of the funding of Letterkenny University Hospital, and much has been talked about, of course, it's the sixth busiest hospital, but it's bottom of the table in terms of funding, 6,900 odd per patient. Our nearest, probably the best comparison as well, would be Sligo University Hospital, that would have double the investment or spend per patient. Have you any insight as a former Director General of the HSC as to why that might actually be, Tony?
Most of the funding patterns that we see owe their roots in history. And obviously we have a history that was based on health boards. Health boards sought to develop major centres and less major centres. And clearly Sligo benefited from that. That does need to change. One of the fundamental principles of SlauncherCare is equalising the way funding is distributed based on population need, adjusted for health needs and social deprivation and so on. And there are moves in that direction. But at the moment, it's quite difficult when the HSC is running a cash deficit of 1.1 million for it to make those kind of changes that it needs to make. There are, I think, some special considerations relating to Letterkenny. It's relative geographical isolation in the country as a whole. And obviously, once you go north on either of the peninsulas from Letterkenny, you're heading quite some distance into areas that simply aren't served by other hospital services, at least not within the Republic. And therefore, there are some special reasons for concern when you have 13 consultants and the local GP community expressing the alarm, sounding the alarm in the way that they are now. And I certainly hope that their message is being heard loud and clear. But as I say, it's quite difficult for the HSC to respond to any particular concerns when it's being left with the particular financial problem that it has right now, which is the worst in a decade. I took over the HSC in the teeth of the financial crisis for the entire country, and the HSC was being treated better in terms of its budget at that stage, I think, than it is now. And that's really astonishing.
But is there a historic, like, did you encounter anything in your role? And I know it's a huge role and very hard to sort of know everything that's going on within it. But why do you think that Letterkenny University Hospital historically has been so underfunded and neglected? And I mean, it's taken massive campaigns just to retain or to have basic services. Like, is it seen as a problem? Is it seen as insignificant? I'm struggling as to wonder why it's such an outlier, both geographically, but also in terms of the attention from the HSE.
I don't think there's a negative or hostile approach to Letterkenny. I don't think it's seen as a problem. It's certainly recognised as a hospital that has really incredibly strong support from its community. Whenever I visited and met with Sean Murphy, the general manager there, I almost always encountered people from the community in terms of the hospital support group and cancer campaigners and so on, and found it to be a hospital that was well connected with its community and well supported by its community. As I say, it's a historical thing, but the whole Sláintecare project is designed to re-equalise the way funding is distributed across the country. But unfortunately, that's being undermined now by the overall financial settlement for 2024.
The Health Minister, Stephen Donnelly, I understand, has agreed to meet with representatives from the 11 consultants you referenced and also GPs. They have a list of priorities that they believe that need to be acted on. We heard from Mr. Michael Sugrue yesterday that he says we need a 4 to 8 week plan, such as the situation at the moment. Is that within Stephen Donnelly's gift? In other words, what potentially could, so we can manage expectations one way or other, what potentially could a meeting like that succeed with Stephen Donnelly?
Well, obviously, as the Health Minister, he has a significant voice, but he hasn't been supported just recently to the extent that he needs to be. So in addition to meeting with Minister Donnelly, there's at least one other cabinet minister in the county and other TDs as well. I think it's important that they're all appraised of the situation. It's obviously important that Minister Donnelly has agreed to have the meeting, and he can use the information he gathers as part of the overall approach that he's taking to try and correct the problem that's now occurring with the health budget, because clearly it's not tenable when you have a situation such as that's being described by local doctors in Donegal.
Is Minister Donnelly's position tenable, do you think? Because, and obviously he can't speak publicly, but I think it will be very interesting if he ever writes a book to read his account of this period of his political career, because I'd imagine he's not happy.
Well, based on, what he has said at press conferences and his relative silence on his Twitter or X feed recently, it's reasonable to infer that he's not happy. I think his position is tenable in the sense that he is not the person who made these budget decisions. From my own day, I can tell you that the health minister is a policy taker when it comes to budget. These decisions are made on a whole of government basis. And he is clearly in the position now of seeking to correct these problems. And rather than having his position questioned, I think it's important that everyone who supports the further development and improvement in the health service would rather support him rather than criticise him. He's not the architect of this particular problem. He's obviously the guy now in the hot seat trying to resolve it, and that's not going to be easy. And it wouldn't be helpful for those of us who have a big interest in healthcare to make his problems more difficult by calling his own position into question right now. I don't think that would be a good.
And it is interesting how you describe it as a collective decision, which makes it even more bizarre, because everyone around that cabinet table, there's very few of them, will not have constituents that are not happy with the health service, not happy with investment in it and what have you. It just seems a bizarre one. Again, sorry to go back to that one, Tony. It just seems a bizarre decision, and you just wonder, is there a different motivation? Are they saying to the HSE, that's how much money you have, we're not throwing good money after bad, get your house in order?
Well, let's take that head on, this narrative about good money after bad, and this notion that's put about by government ministers that we're a high spender on health. If you look at the spend per capita on healthcare in Ireland, we're in 11th place out of 15 Western European countries. So when you think of the countries that we would like to compare ourselves with, we're well behind them in terms of spending. So So it's not that we're extravagant in the way we fund our health service. One of the reasons we have fewer hospital beds and fewer doctors in other countries, and that's right at the heart of the issues that are being discussed at Letterkenny University Hospital there, is because we don't fund the health system at the level necessary to do that over time. And obviously it would take time to build up beds and doctors, but if we're not even funding, it's not going to happen. There's also this narrative that the HSE consistently overspends. Now, coming into this year, 2023, basic maths, taking into account inflation and demography, the cost of continuing to do what they did in 2022 required an additional 2 billion euros, and they got 900 million. Still big money, but far short of what was required. Going forward for next year, assuming that they are funded to the extra 2 million that they need, or 1.5 billion is likely to be the end of year deficit, the cost of continuing to do what they do is about 1.2 billion, and they're getting funded at 700 million. Mm. What you see is a consistent pattern of underfunding of the health service. And if that continues, it's going to be very difficult for the HSE to manage its financial affairs into the future. So while there's a political narrative, and you see all the junior ministers going out with their speaking notes, you know, must have efficiencies, and we're big spenders, it's simply not true. HSE isn't funded at a level of comparable health services in the countries that we would want to hold ourselves up against. That's a principal reason why we have many of the challenges in the health service that we do. But to land the HSE with what is, roughly speaking, a 2 billion euro problem going into 2024 places them in an impossible position. They're required to put forward a health service plan that is balanced and yet does all the things that we need it to do, and they cannot do both. It was very interesting to hear Bernard Gloster, the CEO of the HSE, saying on national radio on Sunday that the 2024 service plan will have to have an inbuilt deficit because there are things that he simply is not in a position to cut. And that's a really bad position for someone who's only been in the job 6 months to be put in by virtue of what looks like a crazy set of arithmetics and a crazy set of political calculation. And I think they're just going to have to reverse engines and fix this problem.
But even this morning, reiterating that they aren't inclined to do so. And you just wonder what it means, because we also know, Tony, that, you know, not universally, but to a great extent, morale is low. Retention is difficult within the health service. There's that freeze on recruitment. I mean, we often wonder, the good doctors and nurses of Letterkenny University Hospital and other facilities, how long are they going to work in very difficult conditions? And then they look at what lies ahead of them for 2024. You'd fear that it could exacerbate or speed up intentions to get out altogether or move somewhere else. I mean, they may feel it's pretty hopeless.
Yeah, they're not being sent a very good signal right now. And it's a very poor reward for the service that we saw up and down the country, including in Letterkenny, during the emergency phase of the COVID pandemic, a pandemic which, might I add, is not yet over. So this is hardly the right way to encourage people to come and work in the Irish Health Service. And, you know, because of its geographic location, Letterkenny obviously has particular advantages and challenges in that regard. They're very creatively emphasize the ability to go surfing and all that type of stuff, but it's still a difficult place to recruit staff to because of its geographical location, and none of this helps. So before every political U-turn, we see lots of protestations that there's no going back. So I wouldn't be overly influenced by the fact that we're seeing resolute statements that they're not going to revisit this. They have to revisit this.
Okay.
They simply can't allow for the entire budget arithmetic of the country, they can't allow the health service to wander into 2024 on track for a 2 billion deficit. Not good for health, not good for economy, not good for politics, not good for our sense of well-being as a people.
Tony O'Brien, thank you so very much for joining us. Tony O'Brien, former Director General of the HSE and columnist at the Sunday Independent, of course, headed up that organisation, so has a great understanding of it. I was in Letterkenny 3 weeks ago at the hospital. I waited 22 hours for a bed and travelled from Carndonagh. Is it time there was a hospital in Inishowen? St. Luke's Kilkenny Hospital that get the lowest funding in the country, also the most efficient with the lowest ED wait time. So it's not about how much money the hospital gets. It's about efficiency, and Letterkenny Hospital is just not being run efficiently at all. Well, I'd have to have a look at the figures there just in terms of how many patients they deal with and what have you. Greg, good to hear Betty Holmes on, and she still hasn't lost her passion for our hospital. Brings back the memories of when we brought an estimated 15,000 people onto the streets, and RTE reported it as 6,000. Probably needs to happen again. Thousands are used for public transportation on sending patients from A to B and home on discharge when they have no way home in the early hours. Are the lights on yet at the Polestar, by the way? I think it was mentioned in our interview yesterday that they're going to be switched on in the afternoon. And my apologies if you're listening in Donegal Town or Dunloe or Carndonna and you're not going anywhere near Letterkenny and you're going, well, why is he talking about a set of traffic lights miles from where I am? But obviously, you know, many thousands of people will travel through that roundabout today, as they do every single day, massive amounts of people. And it is a gateway through to the west. And what have you, of the county. Are they on yet? How are they working? Let us know. 086 60 25,000. Delighted to welcome back into studio Josephine Corkery, member of the Special Needs Parents Network in Donegal. Good morning to you, Josephine.
Morning, Greg. Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much for calling up. Josephine, just before we get to yesterday's meeting, because things have moved kind of quickly, really, yeah. Haven't they? Talk to us about the establishment of this group, the numbers involved, and the processes you've been going through up until now.
Yeah, absolutely. So we set up the group on the 15th of September. So we're just over a month old. We hit 600 members yesterday. I suppose our primary tool for engagement with our members is through Facebook. And we hope in the future be looking at other, you know, in-person events and things like that. But at the moment, that's our primary vehicle. So we've 600 members. The purpose of our group, as we always set out, was to provide a loud, unified voice to help us advocate for our children. And also, you know, to provide peer-to-peer support. Where do I access XYZ? Mm. This is an issue I'm having at home. Anybody have any advice? Because we all have that lived experience as parents of children with disabilities and additional needs. It's important to say, I suppose, that we are members and we encourage, you know, families and parents to get involved of children with all disabilities and of all ages. So, you know, if your child is an adult, they're still your child. You still have to care for them. So we would be very inclusive in that way, and that we want to bring as many people together so that we can effectively advocate for all of the issues that we're experiencing. And they're very varied, to be honest. As we mentioned, I suppose, a couple of weeks ago, the CDNT, the Children's Disability Network team, and the support that children with additional needs and disabilities under the age of 18 that they're getting is very wanting at the moment. There's huge issues with that, and you've been very, you know, excellent here at the radio covering that and keeping that a live issue for us. So that was our first issue that we're looking for, or we were looking at. We prepared a report on that we launched just yesterday on the stakeholder impact of the CDNT crisis. Purpose of that report, as we mentioned, was we wanted to provide, I suppose, an evidence-based, factual review on the impact of the crisis on the various stakeholders. The HSE and, I suppose, the various parties are very used to hearing from parents who are struggling. And sometimes we feel, you know, that maybe it's like shouting into the wind. So we needed to come together. We needed to have that, you know, I suppose, loud, unified voice.
It can't be ignored now.
Yes,
exactly. It can't be ignored.
Exactly.
And it's not individuals sending a letter or making a phone call or the occasional interview. I mean, 600 members in a month is remarkable because everybody's different. Not everyone, firstly, is on Facebook, but wants to sort of even be... Not everyone sort of wants to be that person that's part of that either. Now, they're probably watching on if they can, but so to get 600 is really quite remarkable. Now, before we get to the meeting and what's been done here, like, the one thing I've noticed over the last month, which is really quite remarkable, and particularly in the last week, is a rush of adverts to fill these positions. Which, because we were saying, well, where are these ads? There's radio ads for them.
There is.
There's adverts actually on Facebook, promoted ads. Mm-hmm. Like, there is an act. Now, there's a short-term, medium-term and long-term situation here, right? But now, all of a sudden, we are seeing an active campaign to hire people into Donegal CDNT.
Yeah.
So, that, in the first instance, That's a victory, I think. That's a victory.
It absolutely is. And I suppose the parent representatives in each of the areas have been really pushing that recruitment piece. We spoke to the HSE yesterday and, you know, there's a lot happening on the recruitment piece. There absolutely is. There's a lot of, you know, work to try and get the message out there, to try and attract the individuals that we need into the CDNT teams, those talented, experienced, really valued individuals. So there is absolutely work going on there. Our perspective from the Special Needs Parents Network maybe is slightly different to the recruitment
that.
Piece.
I get that.
And we really wanted
well,
to
Well, articulate that for us. What you told the HSC and local reps yesterday.
Yeah, so I suppose the meeting yesterday was very positive, I will say that first of all. And, you know, there was a very much a genuine effort to listen to ourselves and our perspective and to listen to the parent representatives. And each and every person, I suppose, that presented had a different aspect, which was really, really useful. So I suppose with regards to it, we spoke about our view, which is we can speak about recruitment, but recruitment in its very nature is aspirational. We hope to be able to recruit. And, you know, we would have concerns, I suppose, as an organisation, Greg, that the supply is very low out there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we can, our concern and our primary, I suppose, focus is recruitment takes time and our children cannot continue to wait. So we presented four interim emergency measures to the HSE yesterday. We had surveyed our members on them and we got a lot of feedback from individuals who have children with disabilities and additional needs as to what would help them right now and in the next 6 months and in the next 12 months when we're waiting for recruitment and, you know, supply to increase. So those four measures were, first of all, a clear pathway for children to access equipment from the HSE. That needs to happen ASAP, and the HSC committed to come back to us within 7 days.
And that's people who are outgrown a wheelchair or don't have access to one. And okay, so that just so people know that what equipment is second.
Exactly. So wheelchairs, standers, you know, orthotics, anything that, you know, even communication devices, things like that, anything that helps a child lead a functional life. And the cold reality of it is there are children out there who have orthotics that are too small for them that are cutting into their ankles.
Now, what's orthotics?
Orthotics are like splints.
Okay, get
you. Or a lot of, like an AFO would be kind of a leg brace.
Understood. I know exactly what
you're on
about. Yeah,
so it's a plastic leg brace. Yeah. And if that's not fit correctly, it's fit for each individual child. Mm-hmm. If it's not fit for correctly, it will cause you a lot of pain.
Okay. What was the feedback in relation to that strand one?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was no excuse around that.
Okay.
There was none.
Hands
so they
up.
Committed. Hands
this
up. We should have
right,
done
okay.
that. Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely.
All right.
The second one was around urgent redeployment of trained and experienced clinical therapists from other areas. Because, you see, I suppose something we're worried about is, well, first of all, we have children who, and some of them fed into a report. There's one child in particular that we had a statement from his parent. You know, he has 80% scoliosis. He's on the list for surgery with a surgical team, the spinal surgical team down in Crumlin. He will not be able to get that surgery unless he gets physiotherapy and occupational support now.
Yeah, and it's obviously those surgeries, it's problematic at the moment because of his further controversy, but he also needs to be prepped for when.
And so, needs to have after-surgical care there. So our concern is that little boy, and there are many other little boys and girls and adults around the country who cannot access surgery because of what's happening here. And they, you know, they will be in pain and that will have a massive impact on their lives.
What was the feedback on that?
We will look at it. I suppose what we were saying was you need trained and experienced people now. Mm-hmm. We also need trained and experienced people to train up the new individuals that are coming into the service, because what you're going to have, like if you look at Donegal East, there's only one trained therapist currently on that team. Mm. She's an SLT. They're waiting for another 8 or 9 more. So there's going to be a brand new team. You need to have that experience to support them in their role. That one, we'll see. They said they'd be back to us within 30 days on that one. We asked for an interim emergency model to support children access in private therapy and diagnostics. So basically, 70% of the individuals who completed our survey spoke of how they pay for private therapy at the moment. So private SLT, private physiotherapy, occupational therapy and psychology, behavioural therapy, play therapy and a few other things. That puts a huge strain on families financially. Yeah. And they have no other option. Like I'd mentioned here the last time I was speaking to you, Greg, like my daughter is quite severe. We have no choice. Mm. It's like bread, water, shelter, physio, OT. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. So we have no choice. We and these services, you know, are, I suppose, doing the job that the HSE should
of
be
course,
doing.
Yeah.
Plus, the budgets are unspent at the moment. We're not asking the HSE to spend any more money here mm-hmm. with any of this. So that was something that we spoke about. They're going to revert to us within 30 days.
Again, to see if there's some way they can assist parents in that.
So and there are.
Okay.
There are. We spoke to them about models that are currently out there that can just be replicated.
Right,
because
okay.
what we hear is, oh, what about governance? Or what about car? Or what about this? And what about that? And you're like, you know what? Let's just put the child at the center mm-hmm. of our conversation and think about what does the child need? You know, we can manage all of the other
And if
concerns.
You've got faith in your long-term plans, then you're only ever committing to an interim measure.
Exactly.
So
this
if
is
you
an
don't,
emergency
exactly.
measure.
So you're not looking, well, no one's looking for this to be the long-term solution.
No.
But if you are serious about hiring, then we all agree this is interim and it's for the children and the families. Let's get on with it.
Yeah.
All right.
Exactly.
So that's a 30-day
revert. That's a 30-day revert. And then the last one was, and one of the key stakeholders that we spoke to in the development of a report was the schools. You know, because we felt, you know, there are schools out there, there are special ed schools, there are schools where they have ASD classrooms, there are schools with, you know, mainstream schools with children that have disabilities and mm-hmm. additional needs. And those schools are struggling without the support. What we used to see a number of years ago was that, you know, therapists, trained therapists would go into the school to support the SNAs and support the teachers, support the children accessing their education. That doesn't happen anymore. And we had, you know, really good engagement from schools around the county. We're really, really grateful for that. And, you know, you can see and feel the frustration. Just even there's one fantastic quote from a mainstream school that talks about, we are teachers. We're not physiotherapists. Mm-hmm, we're not occupational therapists. We are teachers and we're trying our best, you know, and we're having to plug the gap. It's impossible for us to plug that because we're not, you know, we're not experts in that field. We're teachers, you know, and schools spoke about, you know, and families have spoken of this as well. There is a deterioration in the amount of care that our children are getting, you know, and even I know you were talking about Letterkenny Hospital before I came on, you know. If things are getting worse, we're getting better off as a country, but things seem to be getting worse for the people who really need it, you know?
The public know that, though. You see, there's a couple of things going on. We hear one reality, but we live a different one.
Yeah,
okay?
So
I'm not silly now. I think we're as clever as we've ever been.
Yeah.
Right, okay. So what response did they give to item four there?
Yeah, they said they would look at that and they'd be back to us within 30 days. So we're very fortunate. They said that they would be back to us, you know, in terms of, you know, we can measure when they'll be back to us. We will, you know, make it very clear and, you know, get the feedback back to all of our members and the general public about what the HSE are saying to us about the feasibility of these measures. Everyone is watching. Mm-hmm. You know, the schools are watching, the other stakeholders. We engaged with ex-CDNT colleagues who spoke about the really difficult working conditions.
Yeah.
And what could be done to support.
Yeah. And, you know? And this is part of this is to support those that are currently there who are overstretched
Absolutely.
And stretched. And
yeah.
I hope they get that. I think they
do.
Yeah,
they do.
It's not a criticism of the staff of the CDNT.
Definitely
to say,
not.
Right, we know the work you do. You need backup here.
Yes.
You
know? And we spoke about that. Like we were here. We were there yesterday to speak about how valuable the CDNT services are.
So, Josephine, we're going to have to do another update in 30 days.
Yep.
But there just is no doubt that things are a little bit different now.
Things are
obviously
moving.
You know, we have to wait and see what is achieved. But I know, and maybe it's just anecdotally, I know that there are people that have contacted me since this went big that all of a sudden hadn't heard from certain organisations for 6 months and they got a letter to say, you know.
Hello.
Exactly.
Here we are.
Exactly. So, you know, now I'm not sure that could just be pure coincidence.
I know.
But between the jigs and the reels, there's a very important meeting that's taken place. There's some acknowledgements of situations and some commitments.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to come back to this in 30 days. But I
Brilliant.
Think compared to where we were at,
we're getting
something's
somewhere.
Happening.
Yeah, we are.
There's something because I know this. As I say, I know there's a huge push in advance to that meeting to get ads out.
Yeah, no.
So that in and of itself
shows that someone
is remarkable.
Yeah.
Okay. So, and I want to congratulate likes yourself, Josephine, and all of those involved in this. You can't pat you on the back yet.
No,
but my point is that 600 families come together.
Yeah.
And they can't be ignored. And this is what it's all about. And I think it's remarkable. Were you happy with the political representation at that meeting?
Very much so. Yeah. Okay. No, they were all there, which we didn't actually expect initially. But yeah, no, they were all there and they're very supportive of it. And, you know, I guess like we did speak about how this will be an election issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so absolutely. So it's
the old election issues are piling up.
They are. They're going to have a busy year.
Piling up around here. Listen, as I say,
Thank you so much, Greg.
Josephine, to you and all involved.
Brilliant. Thank you.
All right. Okay. That's Josephine Corkery, there, member of the Special Needs Parent Network in Donegal, with an update on the outcome of that meeting yesterday. We'll wait 30 days and see where we are then.